We're going to finish up today. We've been talking about politics and religion for 3 weeks, so we're going to finish the series today, and then you can all go vote on Tuesday, and then we'll move on to other stuff. In your notes, don't get terrified when you see how many notes are there. We covered half of those last week. We did part one last week, the first two pages. So page 3 and 4 are what we're going to cover this morning. Finishing up, talking about politics in a biblical worldview. All right. Now, remember, I don't know if you guys are enjoying this or if I've made anyone angry yet. Usually you tell me if you're enjoying it, not if I've made you angry. But if that's the case, remember, I'm not endorsing any particular candidates or parties. I'm dealing in principles and trusting you to be intelligent enough to figure the rest out for yourselves. Amen? So, let's jump in because we got a lot to cover today, and this is interesting. And as we've done in the past, I'm going to get into a little bit of our history and things because you don't always get that anymore. And so, as you can, if you take a couple seconds, you can see we've already covered 3 of our principles on pages 1 and 2 of a biblical worldview, what it means to have a biblical worldview, and how that relates to politics and voting and things like that. So you can jump right to page 3. We're going to jump in with our 4th principle, rights and responsibilities. How many of you like having rights? How many of you like having responsibilities? Less so, right? Okay. So the question we want to answer today on rights and responsibilities is the way to look at these things through the lens of individualism or collectivism. And again, I'm using some terms here that are semi-political terms just so they fit. What it comes down to is, are rights and responsibilities of an individual concern, or do we collectively have them? Are we Star Trek, or are we the Borg? Do we get assimilated, or do we get to have individual rights and responsibilities? Okay? Now, I'm going to talk about that. Collectivism is basically the concept that the collective is more important than the individual, that the group is more important than the individual, that the group rights are more important than individual rights. And both of those concepts are being espoused, whether you realize that or not. We have to decide which one is a biblical worldview. Now, I'm not going to get into globalism, but I do want to mention it because you hear about it. It's one of the hot political topics lately. And all I want to do in mentioning it is say this. There are nations in the earth. They were God's idea. They were His design. In fact, globalism is the concept of all the nations coming together and doing things together on the same sheet of music, that we all believe the same things it's really collectivism on steroids, okay? It's collectivism on a global scale instead of a national scale. There will come a time when all of the nations gather together in unity and agreement over one thing. They'll do that in a valley called Megiddo, just outside Jerusalem, and the one thing they'll agree on is that they have to fight a war against Jesus. It's not going to go well for those nations. Jesus is, you can read about this in your Bibles, there's a lot of blood, a lot of dead people, okay? That's where he talks about he will execute kings in his wrath. And so the nations will gather globally and be unified over this one thing. Now, here's the interesting thing. Jesus is going to deal with the nations there, but you know what we see in the Bible in the millennial period, in the 1,000-year reign, when Jesus is reigning from Jerusalem, he's dealing with nations. He does not do away with them. He doesn't say, bad, you guys got together and fought against me, we're not going to have nations anymore. He says, bad leaders, let's go back to having nations the way we're supposed to. So nations were his idea, and until there's a new heaven and a new earth at least, there will be nations. So there you have it. Now, what I really wanted to get into is this thing with rights and responsibilities. And before we talk about this, I didn't just say rights, I said rights and responsibilities, because you need to get this. This is huge. Teach your children this, because I'm not sure that the schools are teaching your children this. Rights and responsibilities are inseparable. They go together. If you want rights, you have responsibilities. If you don't want to be responsible, you don't need rights. Okay? They go together. They are inseparable. I love, Rachel was listening to Rabbi Zacharias recently, and he was talking about this, and he talked about how God has given us the wonderful gift of choice. He didn't have to do that. It's pretty wonderful. He's given us this incredible gift of choice. He knows better. He gives us good advice, but he allows us to choose. But here's what he didn't give us. We don't get to choose the outcome. We can choose our action, but we cannot choose the outcome of our action because the consequences are tied to or bound to the choice. That makes sense? Okay? It's real simple. You know, Rachel and I are, you know, trying to diet a little bit. I have the choice of whether I'm going to go home and eat too much. But if I choose to go home and eat too much, I don't have the choice to lose weight after that. There's a consequence bound to that choice. Life is full of choices that have consequences bound to them, right? And so you got to get this, that rights and responsibilities are inseparable because we have a generation that will scream about rights and shun responsibilities. Now, this is, you know, that's kind of endemic. You know, every teenager I've ever known, including myself, really liked their rights and did not like their responsibilities. I wanted the right to do what I wanted on the weekend. I did not want the responsibility of doing chores, right? My parents seemed to feel like those things went together, that if I want to do what I want on the weekend, I should do what they want during the week, right? You guys get this? Okay, good. So, rights, responsibilities, inseparable. They go together. So, here's the question about individualism versus collectivism. Too many isms. Do we empower individuals or do we empower the state? Do we empower individuals or do we empower the state? In other words, who gets to make these choices which will determine outcomes? Does the state get to make them, or do individuals get to make them? A better way to say it is, who serves who? Does the state serve individuals, or do individuals serve the state? So that's the question we want to answer in looking at individualism versus collectivism. Now, we've already talked about some of this, so some of it's pretty clear. The founders were very clear. The founders, as we talked about last week, believe that men have rights and that these were rights given to them not by the government but by God, inalienable rights, and that the government needed to be restrained. The entire Constitution is not telling the government what it can do. It's telling the government what it cannot do. It is a restraint on the government because they believe individuals have rights. Now, I want you to consider the opposite. What if the opposite were true? Because there are some governments that in the nations in the earth where the opposite is true, where they believe that the government has rights, and because the government has rights, or the government gets to choose, individuals need to be restrained. Someone's freedom is going to be restrained. The question is whether it's going to be individuals' freedom or whether it's going to be the government's freedom. And there's a dynamic tension there, and if you aren't careful, like our founding fathers, to set up restraints for the government will take control and restrain individuals. Now, so who gets to choose and determine the outcome? Our founding fathers believed that men, not government, should be the choosers, right? Now, what about the Bible? We've looked at Romans 13, again, every week so far we've been talking about this, where it talks about submitting to government authorities. And it says in Romans 13 that the government officials are God's ministers to you for good. Anybody know what the word minister means? It means, that too. That's right, we just learned that. It means to serve. It means servant. So, it's very clear in the Bible, God's intention is for governments to serve men, not for men to serve governments. Now, don't shout anything out, but can you think of some historical or even contemporary governments where the people exist to serve the government, not the government exists to serve the people? Okay, that's not God's design. God's design is that government serve men. America, we have to decide whether we're going to believe that the government is here to serve us or that we exist to support the government, okay, to serve the government. Now, that being said, I want to get into social justice. That is a hot button topic right now, right? Social justice, what does that mean? And sounds good, and you know, we're Christians, so we ought to be all about justice, right? We serve the just God. But we have to understand, first, what justice is, and second, what it means to exercise social justice. We should be good at this because Jesus has been doing it the entire time he's been God. And so we should be able to learn from him. So let's begin to look at what these things mean. And the contrast we're looking at with social justice is a contrast of freedom versus regulation. Now, some regulation is necessary. You want to raise your kids, for example, to be able to handle freedom. But the younger they are, probably the more regulation you place on them, right? And so we know that there's some that's necessary. Regulation is another word for control. And it's appropriate probably to control your 5-year-old, probably not appropriate to control your 25-year-old. If you're still controlling 25, you probably have issues, okay? So, but we're talking about this in the context of government. Social justice, is the path to social justice through freedom or through regulation? See, because if we're not careful with our government, control can become condescension. Now, if that's hard for you to understand, I need you to just know that I'm smarter than you. I'm a professional. I've been doing this a long time, and you need to just trust me. Does that sound familiar? Have you been told that by any government officials lately? And I'm not picking on either party. They both got them. That condescension, that concept that the elite, that the smarter, you know, for God's sake, we have Harvard and Yale law degrees. What are you doing questioning us? There's a certain amount of condescension that comes with regulation. And so we have to be careful about the kind of power we allow and the kind of condescension we're willing to accept. So I want you to understand, to answer the question whether freedom is a better method of achieving social justice or regulation is a better method of achieving social justice, okay? Now, let's understand the difference between justice and fairness. Justice, a really simple definition, justice says equal opportunity. I'm going to make sure that everyone here has equal opportunity, that each of you has freedom, and in that freedom, you have responsibility, individual freedom and responsibility. So for example, all of you, here's justice. All of you are free to get jobs, and whatever you make in your job, you can spend it however you want. Thus saith Tony. Okay? That's justice. I will make sure no one hinders you from not having the same opportunity everyone else has. But you're responsible to do with that opportunity whatever you want. And what happens, it's your responsibility. That's justice. Fairness deals with not equal opportunity, but equal outcome. And fairness requires external regulation. So if I want to provide justice, I say you all can go get jobs and keep what you want. If I want to be fair, I'm going to have to say that you all have to have exactly the same amount of money, no matter how hard you work or what job you do. Now, I could say, all right, let's be fair. Everybody bring your money every week and work it out so that you're all even. But that'd be really difficult for you guys to do, wouldn't it? Wouldn't it be easier if I just took all that money and for a small administrative fee, I could divide it up and make it fair. And each of you would go away every week with exactly the same amount of pay, whether you work for Harris or for McDonald's. That's fair. It's fair.
isn't it?
Okay. And so, which one is social justice? Because there's people that will tell you both of those are, and we should figure out which one is a biblical worldview. Which one is social justice? Is social justice about justice or about fairness? Now, let me just start by saying God is not fair. He is just. Justice is the foundation of his throne. He is not fair. I'll give you an example. In Matthew 20, he tells this parable. He says, hey, there was a guy, and he went out and he said, I need some work done in my field. I'm going to pay a denarius a day for you to come work in my field. And there's guys sitting around. They said, we'll do it. And he goes, all right, get to work. And he comes back midday, and there's some more guys sitting around. And he goes, I need more guys working in my field. They go, okay. And he comes back towards the end of the day, and he goes, there's a guy still sitting there. He goes, what are you guys doing sitting here? He goes, well, no one's hired us. So we'll go on, work in my field. And so he comes and he gets ready to pay him. And he starts with the guys who started latest in the day. And he gives them a denarius. Now, what are the guys who were thinking, what are the guys thinking who were the first ones that came? They're thinking they're going to get more. What were they promised? A denarius. So when he gets to those guys, he gives them a denarius also. And they go, hey, this ain't fair. You ever done that? This ain't fair. We've borne the heat of the day. I worked 12 hours today. That guy worked 2 hours, and we both got the same. You've made us equal. And Jesus says, hey, I promised you a denarius. Why are you angry that I'm generous? Isn't it my money to do with whatever I want? So Jesus wasn't interested in being fair. He was making a point there. Right? But we are quick to cry, not fair. Well, it's his money to do with what he wants. God is not fair, but he is generous. I submit to you that generous is better than fair. Just my opinion. Now, so let's take this and let's apply this to some government concepts that exist, okay? Let's compare, and again, we're talking about is freedom better or is regulation better? Do we want justice, equal opportunity, or do we want fairness, equal outcome? All right? Now, let's look at taxes versus, have you heard the term wealth redistribution? Both parties use this term. It's not exclusive to only one party. They use it in different ways. Both parties do this. It's not exclusive to one party. So almost every politician ever has done this because it's a way to gain favor. So, taxes versus wealth distribution. Are taxes biblical? Yeah. Romans 13, 6 and 7 says specifically, the government is your servants for good. This is why you pay them taxes, so that they can earn a living serving you. And so, it's appropriate to pay taxes. It's appropriate to pay taxes for the things the government does, you know, infrastructure, you know, protecting you, you know, doing all the things the government does, running legislation, paying salaries, that's all appropriate. Is it appropriate for the government to redistribute wealth? To say, rich people, we've got some poor people over here, we're going to take some of your money and give it to them. Is that appropriate? Is that biblical? Well, let's look at it. And what's going on here, well, I'll get that in a minute. Okay. So let's look at the early American colonies. You guys remember them? The first two early American colonies, a lot of them were Puritans, they came over and they thought, let's do that Book of Acts thing. We're going to have common land. We're all going to work the land. We're all going to share. We're going to have everything in common. And it lasted about a year, maybe two. And they said, this is not working. We got lazy people laying around. We got people not working. We got some people doing all the work. We got the 80-20 rule going on, whatever. They said, we're moving on from Acts. We're jumping to Thessalonians, where Paul said, if you don't work, you don't eat. No more common land, this is your land, this is your land, this is your land, this is your land. Work it, eat what comes from it. Capitalism. That's why they did it, because it didn't work. They tried the whole, you know, common land thing. It didn't work. So the early colonies learned really quickly that redistribution of wealth or a shared purse disincentivized people, and they didn't prosper until people until they went for individualism, not collectivism. Okay? Now, here's why. When you remove responsibility from rights, when you say you have rights but you have no responsibility, you remove incentive. If I have no responsibility, why bother? If it doesn't make any difference whether I get up at 7 and go to work or whether I get up at 10 and go to work, when are you getting up and going to work? Okay, we got some ambitious people here that want to get up at 7, I guess. I'm not sure. I'm going to get up at 10 or whenever I want, because why? Who cares? There's no incentive. I get the same no matter what. There's no incentive. There's no initiative. Why should I better myself? Why should I learn? Why should I innovate? You know, it doesn't change my pay, right? Why should I invent new medical procedures if at the end of the day I'm going to get paid the same thing? So it doesn't incentivize. It doesn't bring initiative. And here's the worst thing it does when we remove responsibilities. If you ask wealthy people to talk about poverty, they will generally talk about it in financial terms. If you ask very poor people to talk about poverty, they will generally talk about it in terms of dignity, because it's not dignified to have to depend on others, is it? And if we put people in a place where we're saying you have no responsibility, just take what we give you, we rob them of dignity. Right? And so that is a consequence of the difference between taxes, which are appropriate to pay for genuine government functions, and wealth redistribution, where we take away responsibility for earning money and say, we'll just take care of you. If you don't have enough, we'll just give you more. And we end up robbing them of dignity. Now, God, by the way, loves generosity, but he desires voluntary generosity. You get no credit for being generous with other people's money. You understand? There was at least one congressman in history who understood this. How many of you have heard of Colonel David Crockett? He has a song, Davy. Yeah. Yeah. Well, he was a colonel. He was a congressman from Tennessee. And he has a speech that was semi-famous. It's a short speech. It was called his Not Yours to Give speech. So here's what happened. He was in Congress, and they were voting to, as a small bill, they were voting to give some money to a Navy widow. Now, that's a good cause, isn't it? How many of you like the Navy? All right, good. Two of you, all right? Yeah, you know, we live in Florida. We should like the Navy more. We got water in us. This was a Navy widow, and she had come on hard times because of being a widow. And so the Congress was voting to give her some money. And David Crockett said, I'm not going to vote yes to this because it's not ours to give. It's not appropriate for the government to be involved in charity. It's not appropriate for the government, essentially, to be redistributing wealth. He goes, here's what I'll do. This is because this is what he understood how these things work. He said, I make less than anybody here. He goes, I'll donate a week's salary to this woman, and if you all do the same, she'll end up getting more than we would have given her anyway. But I won't vote for us to give her other people's money. Yeah. What I wouldn't give for a few congressmen like that today. He's the only one I know of that's ever said that. There might be others, but I don't know. And no one's done it recently. But the concept is what I want to get at, that he recognized that it wasn't appropriate for a government to give other to redistribute wealth, to give other people their money. So here's what I want to get at. And again, some of this is my opinion. You can feel free to disagree with me. But, you know, remember, I'm a professional. Just kidding. Sorry. Regulation provides justice. It's a guarantee of individual freedom and opportunity. There's some really good regulations. Child labor laws are good regulations. Things like that. You know, antitrust laws are good regulations. They guarantee that we have freedom, we have the same opportunities, and that people aren't abused. But it goes too far when regulations try to regulate outcome. It's for a biblical worldview, it's appropriate to regulate opportunity so that we have justice. It is inappropriate to try and achieve fairness by regulating outcome because it takes away individual responsibility. Does that make sense? Okay, so keep that in mind. Now, so that being said, I put this in bold letters. We empower individuals. I think we've seen here that biblically, and our founders thought the same way, the point is not to empower the government or the state. The point is to empower individuals. We empower individuals by freeing them, not by restricting others' individual freedoms. Let me say that again. We empower individuals by freeing them, not by restricting others' individual freedoms. We use the example of redistribution of wealth. If I go, Tim's making $100,000 a year, and Gary's making $50,000 a year, and I go, Tim, I'm going to take $25,000 from you and give it to Gary, and you're both making $75,000 a year, Gary's a little freer, isn't he? But he's only free at the expense of Tim's freedom. So I've taken from Tim's freedom to give to Gary's freedom. We don't free one person by restricting other individual freedoms. Now, I used money there because that's just easy to see as an example. Jesus did that a lot because it's easy for us to get. But it's not just finances. It's everything. We don't take from other people's freedoms to free ourselves. A good place to see this, the Bill of Rights, by the way, is the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, happened within a couple years of the ratifying of the Constitution. I don't remember exactly. But they're mostly about individual freedoms, not state freedoms, individual freedoms, okay? The First Amendment guarantees us the freedom of speech. So again, let's look at this principle. We empower individuals by freeing them, not by restricting other individual freedoms. Let's say you and I have a differing belief, right? Now, you could say, well, freedom of speech means you can believe what you want, and I can believe what I want, and we can both talk about it as much as we want. You could say that. Or you could say, my talking about it makes that person uncomfortable, and so we're going to call that hateful, and we're going to restrict that kind of speech so that this person feels more free. We're going to limit your freedom to free that person to talk about their thing without feeling uncomfortable or offended. We could do that. Would we? Is this making sense? So I'm telling you guys, we got to get this. We don't empower individuals by freeing them. I'm sorry, we empower individuals by freeing them, not by restricting other freedoms. And the truth is, would that person be any more free? Maybe from offense, but they're not any more free by my freedoms being restricted. The intention was that we're all free to believe what we want, to say what we want, as long as, you know, we're not beating each other up, right? So, continuing in the Bill of Rights, the Ninth and Tenth Amendments are interesting, especially mostly, this is mostly the tenth one. It says that powers not specifically given to the U.S. government belong to the states or to the people. Here's the thinking on this. You got to get this. Here's the thinking on our founding fathers saying, we're going to delineate clearly the limits of the federal government. We're going to delineate clearly what powers they have. And then we're so concerned about them taking too much upon themselves that we're going to say clearly, Anything we didn't list, they don't get. No assumptions. It goes to the states or to the people. Right? That's the intention. Why? Because in the argument of which is better, federal versus local government, they said local. Because they wanted to push things toward individual freedoms, not towards state. That was the intention of our founding fathers, and they had good reasons for that. Here's a simple way to look at federal government versus local government. The bigger and farther away government is, the less influence people have. Do you feel like you could influence our local Brevard County school board? Yeah, you could bother them. You know where they live. You could drive there today, right? How about our state representatives in Tallahassee? Feel like you could have some influence on them? All right. How about Washington? Not as much. How about California? Not a bit. Right? The farther away it gets, and the bigger it gets, the less influence you have as an individual. Our forefathers knew this, and so they were trying to push government towards individuals, not towards the big state. Okay? They knew, I think, what they were doing. Now, we see this principle. Abraham Lincoln, wow, we're going to make it. The second page is really fast. We see this principle. Abraham Lincoln made a statement that is so famous, probably you think it's in the Constitution, because we hear it all the time. It was a great statement. At the Gettysburg Address, Abraham Lincoln said that the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. You guys heard that before? Government of the people, by the people, for the people. You know where he got it? Prologue to the 1384 John Wycliffe Bible. The Bible is for the government of the people, by the people, and for the people. The Bible is for the government of the people, and by the people, and for the people. That's where Abraham Lincoln got that statement. It's a John Wycliffe statement from the late 1300s. Cool, huh? He recognized that it's a good principle. But the original principle is that the Bible is what does this. And so I want to do something here because I want to answer the question, will the Bible continue to be an influence in our nation, which is supposed to be government by the people, for the people, of the people, or in some order? Now, to do that, we're going to look at a graphic here, and I'm going to have to... This is another hot topic. I'm going to have to explain to you the Electoral College. How many of you fully understand how the Electoral College works? Right. Few. Okay. This is a graphic. I'll explain what this means in a minute. This is the 2016 presidential election results. But we could, if you go back to the last four or five elections, they're all very similar. We could have picked any of them to use them. I am not concerned with which color is your favorite at this point. If you like red, great. If you like blue, great. I'm concerned about you understanding the principle of the Electoral College because it goes into this principle of individual freedoms, individual pushing government to the individual. Now, I don't know if you know this or not, but we are not a democracy. America is not a democracy. In fact, there has not been a pure democracy since Athens in 500 to 400 BC, Athens tried pure democracy. It failed so miserably that no one's really tried it since. Our founding fathers looked at lots of forms of government. They had this one available. They went, no. Here's the kind of things that would happen in Athens. They had about 60,000 voting citizens. The way they would have, it was a pure democracy. Everything. Are we going to war? Let's vote. Right? So, you know, they have a big amphitheater, whatever, where they would gather. Well, on any given day, maybe 5 or 6,000 of those 60,000 eligible voters would show up, and so they'd do a hand vote, and you get home, and you go, hey, Fred, what happened to the thing today? Oh, we voted. We're going to war. Oh, man, I missed it. You know, I had soccer practice with the kids. I didn't catch the vote today. I guess I'm going to war, kids. That was it. That was how pure democracy worked. It was schizophrenic. They were all over the place. They'd vote for one thing and then another thing, and so no one has tried this since then. It just didn't work well. And America is not a democracy. It is a republic, a representative republic. a democratic representative republic. What that means is a republic has representatives that decide things, and the democratic part is we vote for those representatives. We don't vote on every issue. We vote for guys that we think are going to do a good job on every issue. That's how it works, right? So our founding fathers came up with the Electoral College because they were concerned about what they called the tyranny of the majority. That it's the same reason we have antitrust laws. If you turn, I don't know, whatever, Walmart loose, there'll be no other, you know, stores, right? And so they had antitrust laws. It's the same thing. The tyranny of the majority, that minorities would lose their voice, would be squeezed out. Here's how that works. Now, here's in the last election, President Trump, of course, won. You guys know that. Let's see. Okay, good. He won by, he won 30 states. He got 300 against 20 states plus D.C. He got 306 electoral votes against 232 electoral votes. So that's why he won. Electoral votes is what wins a presidential election. Electors, every state has a certain number of electors based on population. And those electors, different states have different ways they do it. Some are all or none, some are split. Those electors cast the vote for the president based on how the people voted, right? Now, here's the interesting thing, though. He had 61 million votes. Clinton got 62 million votes. Who won the popular vote? Clinton. And a lot of people were upset about that. And there's a move right now to get rid of the Electoral College and just make it a popular vote, okay? Which is why I have this map. I want you to see why our founding fathers did this. And again, I want you to understand the principle. I don't care about the colors. I want you to understand the principle of pushing government to the people, not to the big state. So here's the thing. If you look at this, is if you go votes by state, we'd have some red ones, some blue ones. It'd look pretty even. This is votes by county. This is interesting. If you look here, Trump won 2,680 counties. Clinton won 454. But which ones? How did she win the popular vote with winning not even 20% of this number of counties? Well, here's how she did it. Here's Miami. Here's Tampa. Here's Orlando. I think that's Gainesville. Surprised Jacksonville isn't blue. Here's Tallahassee, Atlanta, where else? Indianapolis, Chicago, LA. You get in the picture? Yeah. So here's what'll happen if, and this is why our forefathers did this. This is how smart they were. Here's what will happen if the Electoral College is done away with next presidential election. All you have to do if you're running for president and you want to win is win all the population centers, win all the big cities, and you'll win the popular vote. The rest of America becomes irrelevant, and it's the tyranny of the majority. So if you're okay with Chicago and Detroit and New York and LA and Miami and Atlanta deciding all the big decisions for America, then by all means, let's get rid of the Electoral College. If you feel confident that they're going to represent you well. But all of middle America there becomes irrelevant. So here's the good news is, if you live in Brevard County, if we get rid of the Electoral College, you won't have to worry about political advertising and mailers and phone calls and TV stuff and all that. Because the bad news is, you'll be politically irrelevant. No one will bother to campaign here because there just aren't enough of us. We will become a minority, and we'll be ignored. That's, you understand the brilliance of the Electoral College. Their intention, because you'll hear the opposite, you know, well, you know, it needs to be majority vote so that every voice is heard. Well, that's not how it works. The intention of the Electoral College is to make sure that minority voices were heard, that minority voices have influence. It's an interesting graphic, isn't it? Okay, well, let's move on. So, my question that I wanted to answer was, will the Bible continue to influence American government? Or will it just be the majority? So, my recommendation to you in voting, to have a biblical worldview, if you value freedom and dignity for the poor, and true social justice that gives opportunity, not just a handout, then I would vote for politicians who believe in individual rights and responsibilities, who believe in minimal regulation, who believe in empowering individuals over empowering the state. That's my recommendation. Okay, so let's go quickly here because I need to. This one will go fast. The fifth section I want to talk about, authority, God or men. Biblical worldview. Do men have authority or does God have authority? From God's perspective, has God said, hey, I made it, you rule it, I don't really care? Or does God exercise authority and expect us to recognize his authority? Okay, well, good. That's kind of where I'm at, too. But let's show you from history. I'm going to do a very brief history of the entire planet, politically from God's point of view. Let's start with the garden. How many rules were there?
One.
How many did they break?
One.
Why? Because Satan offered them self-government. God said, you have one rule. Satan said, really? Did God really say that? You know what? Here's the deal. If you do this, you'll be like him, knowing good and evil. You can make your own decisions. You don't need to just follow his rules. You can self-govern. So Satan offered self-government. They took it. And God said, okay, from here on out, I guess humans are governing themselves. Now, he let that go for a while until we come to the flood. The flood is the result, the end of human government. Remember, in the past, I talked about social entropy, about man is not basically good, the fundamental premise of progressivism, that man is basically good, fundamental premise of the Bible, that men have a fallen sin nature and are not good. And so we see man turned over to self-government. By Genesis 6, there's a flood. God destroys men from the earth, except for one family, because Genesis 6, 11, 12, the earth also was corrupt before God, and the earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. So what is the end of human government without God? Corruption and violence. Anybody see any examples of that? Okay, this is not that hard to understand. So let's skip ahead. We start over. He gets Noah. He does the ark thing, gets the animals. Says, we're going to start over. We're going to do it again. And we quickly get to the Tower of Babel, where we read in Genesis 11:4 that what they're interested in is two things. They're interested in self-reliance, and they're interested in not doing God's plan. Remember what God's plan was way back in the garden? Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. So let's see what their heart intentions were. Genesis 11:4, and they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. And God said, no, it's kind of my plan to scatter you abroad over the whole earth. And I'm not comfortable with you guys being interested in making a name for yourselves, so I'm going to give you all different languages, and you're going to scatter. Right? Again, what do you think God might have been concerned about? Is he against unity? No. We have all kinds of Bible. God loves unity. In fact, he recognized that as they came into unity, they'd be able to accomplish incredible things. What he was concerned about is them leaving him out. Last week, I talked about Nebuchadnezzar. Remember? Babylon, this great city, I have created. And God said, bam, critter, 7 years. Go eat grass, grow hair and fingernails. The incredible thing, 7 years later, he makes him king again because his confession now is God's awesome. God is the ruler in heaven. He gives, right? So the whole message of that is, Nebuchadnezzar, I don't have a problem with you being king. I have a problem with you being king without me. You need to honor me. Now you can be king again. Cut your hair. All right? And your fingernails. All right. So, here's a question. If God hadn't scattered them, if he had let them build the Tower of Babel, this great city, any guesses how that would have ended? Anybody think it would have ended in like the just before the flood and corruption and violence? All right. Has anybody noticed the bigger the city you live in, the more corruption and violence there is? I think it's just a magnification of human nature. All right. Anyway, it's probably a good reason to not let our largest cities do all the deciding for our country. But that's just me. You do what you want. All right. So here's what God did. Afterwards, he picks a guy, Abraham. He says, Abraham, I'm choosing you. I'm going to make a people. I'm going to make nations come from you, a chosen people, and through them, all the nations of the earth will be blessed. Remember, that's the problem he gave Abraham. I'm going to make into you a nation, and through you and your descendants, I'm going to bless all the nations of the earth. Well, how are you going to do that, God? Well, here's what we're going to do. First, there's going to be a guy named Moses, and I'm going to give him a law. I'm going to introduce a law. I'm going to reintroduce absolutes. We're not going to let you, we're going back to you guys having some laws. We're not just going to let you wing it anymore. And I'm going to rule you. I'm going to directly interact with you in the earth. I'm going to let all the nations see what it's like under God's government instead of under the government of men. Right? And so he starts to do this with Israel. He brings them into the promised land. Things are going pretty well until, again, we looked at this last week, 1 Samuel 8:5, when they reject God's government. They get nervous. They get afraid of the Philistines. And they go, you know what? Of course, they get nervous because, remember, Samuel's sons were knuckleheads. And so they said, we don't want you to rule over us anymore, God. We want you to give us a king. And God says, go ahead and do it, Samuel. They haven't rejected you. They rejected me from being king over them. They rejected God's government. They did the same thing in the garden. We'd like human government. Thank you very much. Not your government. We feel better with humans ruling us. You get it? Now, I find it interesting, the first two kings God gives them. It's almost like God's trying to make a point. Saul looked very impressive on TV. He was an impressive candidate. He was tall and good looking. And Saul did what the people wanted. Remember, that was his downfall? Saul would have made an awesome politician. If Saul were here today, we'd all be voting for him. That guy looks good on TV, and he does what we want. Human government. He would make an excellent representative in Congress. He will do what we ask him to do, and he looks good. Guys are really quiet. We wouldn't be that shallow, would we? David, the second king God gave them, just did what God wanted. It's almost as if God was going, you want a king? All right, I'm going to give you a contrasting visual right up front. Here's God's government. Here's men's government. Which king worked out better for you? Right? So God doesn't have a problem with human government. He has a problem with being left out of human government. So, one last thing. The Reformation. And again, remember, we're talking about authority. Does ultimate authority reside in God or in men? Even in the church, we have to ask that question. Does authority reside in God or in men? In the Reformation, Martin Luther nails, in 1517, nails the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg door and all that. Essentially, you can boil that whole thing down to this. Sola Scriptura. Now, there were some other points. There were 95. But you can boil it down to this. The church had gotten away from the authority of Scripture and had vested authority in men. At this point, it was papal authority. The whole Reformation was basically about going, no, we need to get authority out of the hands of men and put ultimate authority back in God's hands by making the Scripture the final word on authority, not what church leadership says. You see the principle. It's human nature to let men govern us. And God says, we need to let him govern us. He's okay with men being in positions of authority, being in government. He's not okay with not being the final authority. He needs to be the final authority. So, when we're voting, I'm not saying you always have a chance to vote for Christians, or even that the Christian is necessarily the best candidate. Now, how many of you have known some Christians you wouldn't vote for if they ran for office? Yeah, I love Jesus, but oh my God, no. Right? It's not a guarantee. But when we're considering, I would recommend you vote for candidates who honor God, who recognize that God is ultimately an authority, the authority. I would recommend that you vote for honoring God. Now, I'm going to finish with this because I'm almost out of time. Let's just take a moment to talk about power in human nature. You guys have all heard the saying, I forget who said it, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. It happens. So it happened to Uzziah, king of Judah. Uzziah was made king of Judah just before Israel went into captivity. He was 16, he was a young guy. But the Bible says in 2 Chronicles 26 that he did what was right, that he sought God, and because he did what was right and he sought God, Judah prospered. So the whole nation did well. But it says when he became strong, he became proud. And what he did is he got a big head, and the priests were the ones that would go in before God. Well, he thought, well, I can do that. And he got him a censer and put some incense on it, went in before the altar of God. And the priest went, ah! And they grabbed him and drug him out of there and said, what are you doing? You're not supposed to be in here. And he ended up having leprosy until the day he died because he went too far. He went beyond the authority God had given him and tried to act like a priest when he was supposed to just be king. Okay? Now, here's the point. Whoever wins, whether it's your candidate or the other candidate, they need our prayer. I am currently praying for President Trump that God would give him humility, because I know power corrupts. It did to Uzziah. So he needs my prayer. He needs me for you to be praying. He have a revelation of God and have humility, right? Again, doesn't matter whether I voted for him or you voted for him. He's our president. He needs humility. It's good prayer. Right? So regardless of whether your candidate wins or not, they need our prayers. Especially, sometimes I think we back off when our candidate does win. And they need our prayers. Can you imagine the spiritual warfare over our nation? Can you imagine, whether they're aware of it or not, the spiritual warfare the President of the United States and the Congress and the judges and all of them are under because of the weight of the decisions they make every day? They need our prayers. Now, here's what I find interesting. In Isaiah 6, 1, it's the time when Isaiah has this vision of God, and it's a really cool vision. And it says, in the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, saw him in his governmental position on the throne in heaven, high and lifted up, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Now, I don't know if this is true. This is completely speculative on my part. But I wonder, because I know human nature, I wonder if Isaiah saw God because Uzziah died. Uzziah to Israel, if you're a Democrat, he was your John F. Kennedy. If you're a Republican, he was your Ronald Reagan. He was one of the best kings they'd had. I wonder if Uzziah had kind of relaxed, because they had a good king. And when Uzziah died, he went, oh, I better look to God. The reason I wonder that is because I've noticed the church does this. Oh, the wrong guy won. We need to pray. Oh, the right guy won. Whew. Let's go to lunch. Have you seen that? And so what I want to end with is to remind you that ultimately God is in authority, that we can't only look to God as a backup to politics. We can't only look to God if we don't have a good guy or if we aren't getting good laws or we'll find ourselves in trouble. So I want to just remind you where we started, 1 Timothy chapter 2, verses 1 through 2. Therefore, I exhort, first of all, that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, for kings, and for all who are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life with all godliness and reverence. Our ability as a nation to live a quiet and peaceable life hinges on the prayers of the saints for those officials, those government officials in authority over us. And so, yeah, by all means, vote on Tuesday, but whoever wins, pray on Wednesday. All right? We need to be praying for them. Amen. And I left you, I did this last week, but I'm going to do this again. If you are going to be a party person, a Republican or a Democrat or whatever, there's some other ones, Green Party, if you just dig the earth, whatever. Know this, you should go look into your party's platform, see what you're partnering with. At least do your homework. Go look into your party's platform and go, is that what I believe? And go look into your party's history. And I put PragerU.com on here because they have some good videos on the history of the major political parties. Go look into your party's history and your platform and go, do I really want to partner with this? All right? It's just common sense. Do your homework. Be an intelligent, educated voter because we're depending on you to do that. Amen? All right. I'm both out of time and out of notes. So, and we got to vote on Tuesday, so I'm out of time to talk about this before we vote. So we'll do something else next week. Have you learned anything? All right, good.